Welcome to Stepping Out of Babylon, produced by Sue Supriano. Babylon is everywhere. It's the isms and schisms not only within the system, but within ourselves. Let's unify, stand aligned, and step out of Babylon.
Hi, everybody. My name's Sue Supriano, and my guest today is Andrew Kimbrell. We are here at the Bioneers Conference in Marin, California, in San Rafael. And this conference happens every year. It's a very exciting, wonderful conference, bringing all kinds of great thinkers and activists and spiritual leaders together. Andrew Kimbrell is certainly one of those people. He's an attorney, a public interest attorney, and author. His late book here is The Fatal Harvest Reader, The Tragedy of Industrial Agriculture. And we're going to be talking about that. Andrew is also a board member of the International Forum on Globalization. He is a former director at the Foundation for Economic Trends. He founded the International Center for Technology Assessment and the Center for Food Safety. So lots of credentials, and I'm really happy to be able to talk to you, Andrew. We're just meeting. I just heard you speak here at the Bioneers, and so much good work that you're doing. I think I'd like to start out, because it just pops right into my mind, talking about genetic engineering, because that's such scary, important stuff that so many people, so many people don't know about a lot of these things. So you've been fighting that legally and working around that issue.
Yeah, I can't imagine a more urgent issue right now, Sue, than the issue of genetic engineering, certainly specifically as it affects our food. Gee, I'm old enough, Sue, to remember the wonderful appropriate technology movement of the 70s, where the wonderful thinker E.F. Schumacher wrote Small is Beautiful. And I think we always assumed in those days that that people would realize, and people were realizing, that our technological system, the way we industrialized our food system, our energy system, virtually all of our major systems were based on technologies that simply weren't sustainable. And don't forget, in the 70s, that's when we began to first hear about that whole genre of global threats, like global warming and ozone depletion. And so we said to ourselves, goodness gracious, we're going to have to devolve our technologies, right, so they fit living systems. And it's just a matter of time before we say, listen, we can't do this with agriculture anymore, because, we're having nitrogen sinks overfill here. We're just destroying our topsoil. We're destroying our biodiversity. That's going to change. We can't do our energy anymore. We're creating global warming. Our chemical revolution is creating ozone depletion and species extinction, But we hadn't realized something, which is there was another solution. Right? We thought, well, they're going to have to change technology so it fits life. What we hadn't realized is that they had another solution. Let's change life so it fits our current technological industrial system. Let's fit life so it fits our technology. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really important context for looking at the whole biotechnology and genetic engineering revolution. I think it's absolutely critical that we understand that what they're about here is to take the contradictions in the industrial technological system, and instead of resolving them in the direction of life, change life. Let me give you an example, if I could. 50% of our crops out there right now, and there's corn, soy, cotton, canola. 50% of those are Monsanto seeds. And what Monsanto did, Monsanto Corporation, is that it made its fortune on Roundup, which is a herbicide, as you know. But what happens if you spray too much Roundup herbicide on your flowers at the garden or on your crop? Well, it kills the crop and the flowers themselves. So you think, okay, listen, the only way to solve this is to spray less herbicides so that we don't hurt our crops or our gardens, and hopefully someday no herbicides. Well, Monsanto had a different idea. They said, let's not change the way we do agriculture to fit the needs of crops and gardens. Let's change the plants themselves. And this is what they did. They put a resistance gene into these crops. So you can spray as much Roundup as you want on them. They are herbicide resistant. So you can put as much herbicide as you want on these crops, and it won't hurt them. So Monsanto wins in two ways. It sells a lot more of its herbicide, and then it sells these seeds that allow you to spray more and more of these chemicals. Okay, we lose because we get more chemicals in our environments and our bodies. But this is an interesting example of how they're changing literally the genetic makeup of life to fit their corporate profit needs and the industrial system, rather than changing that system to fit life. And by the way, they're also making crops now that resist drought because they're saying we need to have global warming-proof crops. So let's not reduce global warming. Let's change life so it fits the new global warming world. That is the real enterprise behind biotechnology.
And we're also trying to change what can we call them? Animals and animals and people.
People, yeah, you know, that's absolutely true. There was a recent case in France where a three-year-old boy was genetically altered in order to try and cure an immune system that was already being successfully treated, actually. And because of the genetic engineering, he has now a very unique form of cancer that's never been seen before, because the viral vector they used to get those new genes into a cell, the viral vector created its own cancer. And we're also seeing some very, very disturbing work with fish and with animals. For example, several companies are making genetically engineered salmon. By the way, there's 130 other fish varieties that are being genetically engineered. And what they're doing is they're taking a growth gene and they're putting it into the salmon to make it grow much faster, much larger, much sooner. And researchers at Purdue University, which has been followed up by excellent research at Arizona State University, have shown that what happens with this growth gene is it does make the fish bigger. And particularly the male fish, it makes them more attractive in reproduction, right? The bigger fish. But because of the physiological problems created by that gene, they have a one-third greater mortality. So this is like Darwin on his head, right? You're putting these GE fish out there that are more attractive in reproduction, causing a one-third greater mortality percentage in the offspring. These Purdue universities call it the Trojan gene, like the Trojan horse, the gene in there that will destroy native salmon populations that come in contact with these salmon. They said if only 60, now catch this, if only 60 of these genetically engineered fish are put into a native population of 60,000, there'll be complete extinction because of this mathematics in 40 generations, complete extinction. And so we're fighting right now very hard on this GE fish issue. We filed legal actions against the government to stop approval, fighting any kind of release of these fish because of this really terrible, this Trojan gene problem. So there are indeed problems in genetic engineering that go all the way from microbe up to man at this point.
It's so sad. It's just so sad. And even if we want to eat fish, for instance, I understand they're not as good for us. They don't really have the vitamins. And, I mean, even if we're just thinking about ourselves as humans and what we eat, the whole, and, of course, the genetically modified plants and the food plants that we eat to affect us. And it's just so terrible. I heard somebody say today, if we understood the connectedness of all of us. I mean, I guess this is the bottom line. You know, we couldn't be doing these things to other living beings. I mean, living, dead, whatever. It's just really, really horrible. And but it's so important for people to know this information. And, of course, the media and advertising and all that always makes it sound like these things are positive.
Right. And also it's really important to realize that the game is by no means over here. There's only four crops out there that are genetically engineered. Again, corn, soy, canola, and cotton. Wheat, rice, all of our fruits and vegetables, they haven't been approved yet. So we, and fish that I talked about, that hasn't been approved yet. There's insects, trees. We just filed a legal action that stopped genetically engineered grass from being marketed, so lawn grass. So the battle is very much, it's not sad yet. It's the, you know, that is certainly a problem with corn.
Oh, okay. Corn. I didn't realize. Yeah. I thought it was done.
No. These things are not done. And that's why, you know, for instance, if you go to the website of my organization, Center for Food Safety, all one word, centerforfoodsafety.org, you can get involved in each of these battles. And they're coming right now, critical one on wheat, coming up in the Midwest. And here's why I think we have a real chance of winning that, is that the Europeans and our other trade partners, they don't want genetically engineered products. and they demand segregation and labeling when we send it. Well, if in wheat going to Asia and Europe, that's a $175 million export crop for the farmers of Montana, for example. And if the GE wheat comes in there and then, like it has with corn, genetically pollutes the non-GE wheat, they will lose that $175 million export market. Like we now have a $0 export market in corn because no one takes our genetically engineered corn. Well, the wheat farmers have seen this.
Well, how about Mexico? I just heard yesterday about the millions and billions of corn that is being exported to Mexico.
Well, what's happening in Mexico is that people are taking corn down there, and there's been a lot of genetic pollution. But there's no export market. If you look at the numbers, it's zero. $0. And so what's happening with wheat is they're saying, listen, if this happens with wheat, it'll mean the end of North Dakota, Montana, South Dakota, much of Oklahoma, some Texas, where this wheat is. It would be the, so the farmers who have not been our strongest, the conventional farmers and even industrial farmers who haven't been our strongest supporters in the anti-GE fight, the anti-biotechnology crops fight, now are some of our biggest supporters in North Dakota and Montana, and a lot of their legislators are big supporters now. So, and with fish, as much as we hate the aquaculture industry, and by the way, we're working on that industry, not just genetic engineering, but nevertheless, they're with us because they don't want to see their fish destroyed by genetically engineered fish. So we're finding some common partnerships. These battles are very much right now in the making.
And they got to happen fast because at least with plants, the genetically engineered seeds, they spread so fast, right? I mean, just like immediately I talked to Percy Schmeiser from Canada yesterday, sued by Monsanto for using their seeds, and they have police that go around to check people's Monsanto has police. Anyway, you know all about that, but just to let the audience know.
Sure. Well, it's genetic pollution. You know, we're so used to the idea of chemical pollution, and it is horrible. You know, pollution going into a stream. We see the smokestack, the stuff coming out of our cars. We know global warming, all these chemical pollution. Unfortunately, folks, I mean, as much as we need to keep fighting that, but this new era of biological pollution is what genetic engineering has brought us. And these are putting these plants, remember the fish that I was just talking about, once those fish are released into the open environment, you can't recall them. Chemical pollution will usually dilute over time. At least it's localized normally. But biological pollution, and we remember chestnut blight or Dutch elm disease, these were fungi that came over from Asia. Once they got into our trees, we couldn't stop them. All the chestnut trees were gone. All the Dutch elm trees were gone. We couldn't stop them. So that's biological pollution. Now we're putting thousands of these organisms into the environment. And once, once those salmon get out there, what we found with corn now, it's very hard to find organic corn seed because it's been polluted. This is genetic biological pollution. And it reproduces. It disseminates. You can't recall it. So this is why we have to stop right now the introduction of these genetically engineered products and crops, because once they're out there, it will be too late. And the battle is on. The battle is on.
Tell me a little bit about your book here, Andrew Kimbrell, A Fatal Harvest Reader, The Tragedy of Industrial Agriculture. I'm sure that you talk about the subjects that you're talking about now in this book, but just a little bit more so we can urge people to get it, too. It's put out by Island Press, and I imagine you can get it.
Yeah, there's two versions of this book. One is a very large coffee table book called Fatal Harvest. And the idea behind Fatal Harvest was, Susan, many of us live so far away from where our food is being grown in our urbanized society. And so the reason we wanted a large coffee table book is we have pictures. We have pictures of industrial agriculture on one side in the huge coffee table book, and on the other side we have pictures of an alternative organic and organic and beyond. A way of doing things. And so we thought the contrast, so people could really see and learn to see, learn to see the various techniques used in each way, learn to see what one looks like versus what the other looks like, actually see it. So that was the reason for the book, and it's worked out very, very, very successfully. We have over 30 authors who have contributed to it, people like Wendell Berry and Wes Jackson and Jerry Mander and Helen Umberg Hodge. I mean, a lot of the big writers have given us great essays. David Ehrenfeld, one of my favorites. And there's essays on every one of these issues, genetically engineered food and pesticides, what we're doing to our topsoil. Each of these has an excellent, very informed essays. We also have a really good section of the book I like, which is, one of the reasons that these industrial agriculture, agribusiness folks have been successful is that they've been able to get certain lies, some corporate lies. I don't like to call them myths because I like myths. But lies, like industrial food is cheap. Well, it isn't cheap. When you add the environmental and health costs, it's the most expensive food you could possibly buy. Industrial food is safe. It's not safe, not only just for the 80 million of us that get foodborne illness every year, but for the dietary illnesses of cancer and heart disease that are riddling this country, right? Industrial food will feed the world. Oh, no, it won't. The reason that the world is starving is not because we don't have enough food. It's because we're taking farmers, kicking them off the land, right, so that land can be devoted to export crops so we can pay back the World Bank and the IMF from all the loans that have been given them. So these people are shoved off the land. Well, if you're a farmer in any one of these developing countries, you were food independent. You were growing your own food. Now you're shoved off the land. The land is enclosed. You're forced into the big city where you can't find a job. And if you're not growing your own food, you've got to be able to buy it. If you can't buy it, you starve. That's what's happening around the world. And it's Monsanto and their buddies that are creating the starvation. And here they are saying they're going to solve the problem of world hunger. It's an absolute outrage. Mm-hmm. What we've done in this book to develop all the wonderful organizations and writers that help become part of the Fatal Harvest Project, the last part of the book is called Organic and Beyond. And we have a double mission with this movement, which is now becoming a really prominent movement around the country, I'm happy to say. And then people, again, through that website I talked about, centerforfoodsafety.org, can become part of it. This is the idea. We're going to protect the organic standards while we evolve the ethic of organic. So we need to protect these standards, which come into effect in October of 2002, and are an important floor, should be the floor for all agriculture in this country, the organic standards, the federal organic standards. But we also have to evolve the organic ethic. You know, when we first started doing organic, a lot of us, we wanted food that was local and appropriately scaled and humane and socially just and biologically diverse, and maybe even someday this wonderful marriage of farming with wildlife habitat coming together. And that's what we need to develop now. We need to protect the standards and then evolve the ethic into these other ways of farming and promote markets for them so that the farmers doing that can be appropriately rewarded. And what makes this Organic and Beyond thing so exciting for us is that, you know, if you look at our society and you get in front of an audience, even here at Bioneers, Sue, and you were to say to them, raise your hand if you can give up your automobile tomorrow. Mm-hmm. A lot of them, including me, wouldn't be able to raise their hand.
You know? Well, we couldn't get here at this point.
That's right. Exactly. As ashamed as I am to admit it, you know. And it's very, if I say, okay, you make sure you know exactly how every one of your taxpayer dollars is spent. Can't do it, Andy. I don't know what this means. You make sure everything your kid's being taught in school, well, unless you're homeschooling, that's not going to work. What job are you going to have next year? Most people say, gee, I just got laid off. I don't know. We can't even control the work we're going to do, much less make sure it's good work. So we're kind of, you know, we call it a democracy, but in reality we have very little choice in this corporate industrial oligarchy. Food is so important because it's the one place where many of us can make a choice to join a CSA, to buy organic and beyond organic, to have a personal relationship with the farmer, to bring organic food into our schools. So many good things we do to reestablish a real relationship, right? But it doesn't change our lives structurally. It's not like giving up your car. But it changes the system structurally. It brings down this industrial agricultural system, which is creating so much destruction in our farmlands, on our crops, in our soil, in our own bodies, in the bodies of our children. So food is a great entree to this political movement and moral movement against the industrial paradigm, and something we can all do tomorrow. You don't have to wait. Grow your own food. Grow your own organic food. Buy your organic food. It ultimately is cheaper when you look at it. Just stop the junk food. Stop bringing food you don't need into your house, and everyone can afford organic the way it is right now. So join a CSA. Go out and have that relationship. And if you're a farmer, join the CSA movement. And so that's what makes food, I think, such an exciting political moment right now. And there's otherwise fairly dark times, too. I mean, let's face it, with the pending potential invasion of Iraq and all these other pathological things going on, food is like a beacon of light for us, in all of us in our movement, and that's why Bioneers is so important as well, is because it allows for us to have a real functioning movement, a real alternative existing in the society that's fighting the governing paradigm, but it's something we can still all do. That's why I love food as an issue so much.
Yeah, really. Well, we all need it, that's for sure. Yeah. And I certainly have that issue in my life. I'm pretty intent on eating mostly organic food as much as I can, and I have a garden, and I would... It doesn't. You don't really need a lot to grow your own food. You don't need a whole big field. You can grow a lot of food in a very small space.
Yeah, and also I think it's, you know, it really brings us into so many movements. You know, if you're talking about humane farming, in the beyond organic part of this, then you, all the animal groups, all the millions of people devoted to that. Social justice brings us to all the groups working with labor. If we're looking at farming with the wild, it brings in all the environmental and wilderness groups. Local, it brings us into the whole local anti-growth urbanization movement. So by going beyond organic, we link and we connect ourselves with all these wonderful movements around the country. And that's one of the, going to be the real strength of this movement.
And around the world.
And around the world, yeah.
Actually, because there are all these countries. We're talking about Europe and some countries in Africa that won't accept genetically modified food
in Asia too.
Even people who are starving are refusing it because they know how bad it is for you, which is doesn't seem to be the case in the United States. I guess we're, this country is off of the last to know because of the media, or I don't know why it is. How do people know in other countries and they don't know here?
Well, a part of it is planned. When genetically engineered foods were not yet on the market, the Competitiveness Council and the first Bush administration, which was run by Dan Quayle, you remember the guy who couldn't even spell potato, he was the one that decided that we were not going to have labeling or testing of genetically engineered food. He brought in a former Monsanto lawyer from King & Spalding in Washington to become assistant secretary for food policy inside the FDA. They engineered this policy, which they published in the Federal Register, sort of very quietly, at the end of 1992, saying no testing, no environmental or human health testing of GE foods, and no labeling. So when the foods came on the market, there was no labeling and no testing. It was really a sneak attack on the American public and a corporate coup d'etat of the agency. In Europe, that's not what happened. In Europe, the governments were honest and said, we're about to introduce this new food. Do you want it labeled? What kind of testing should we do? And the people said, you bet we want it labeled, and so it was labeled. And now they're involved in the testing. As of last year, 55% of Americans did not even know they were eating genetically engineered food. So the awareness came slow. But a year and a half ago, we filed a legal petition with the Food and Drug Administration demanding the labeling and testing of all genetically engineered food. And now more than 600,000 Americans have written in to support our petition. That's the largest response they've ever gotten on a food issue. So Americans are waking up.
Well, that's good news. I was going to ask, since you're an attorney, what kinds of things that you're working on, and you just said one of them.
Yeah, we're doing a wide variety of legal actions. We're suing the USDA, the United States Department of Agriculture, on the non-enforcement of the organic standards. Just did that this last week. We're suing FDA on genetically engineered foods to force the labeling and testing of those foods. We've filed legal action against five different government agencies to make sure that we don't introduce these genetically engineered fish that we're talking about. We just a while back ago filed legal action against EPA so they would not approve genetically engineered grass that was herbicide resistant. I'm happy to say they did not approve that. They gave in to us, so we've won that one. We've filed legal actions on genetically engineered insects to stop them from being introduced into the environment. Mm-hmm. We've done a lot of that work. We also do a lot of work in animal protection, which is very close to my heart. And we've filed lawsuits against the government, and won two in a row now. One is the one to stop abuse of birds, rats, and mice in laboratories, and the other is to close down those puppy mills across the country. So we have a little side legal action that we like to do on humane animal issues, which I feel very strongly about. We also do a lot of work with the organic community to help do all the legal analysis on the organic standards. So we keep ourselves pretty busy, Sue.
Yeah, I'm sure you do, Andrew Kimbrell. So I'd like to know how are things in Washington, since you live in Washington, D.C.? And, yeah, that's a real broad question, but you can answer it however you'd like to.
Yeah, it's a dark time, Sue, in Washington, D.C. This current administration is a real nightmare in so many different ways, and they're also fairly clever about how they do things. If you're an administrative lawyer, as I am in Washington, you're aware of all the little regulations that are either changing or not adopting, all the little things they're doing that would seem small, but their effect on the natural world is enormous. One small change in forestry policy could mean the death of millions of acres of forest. If they more roads inside our wildlife refuges would mean the destruction of many of those refuges through logging and through, other human activity. Small little changes in food law, in drug law, mean that drugs that are not safe for us and food that us can sneak through. Small changes in the Organic Act over a period of time could fatally undermine those standards. So it is truly a time for vigilance, for monitoring, for constant, and this the average person has no idea of all these minor changes going on. Maybe you read about a few of them in the newspaper, but it's really an avalanche of attacks on all the things that we've all fought for, and not to mention then the larger issue of a new defense policy, as we know, that would mean that we can attack anybody anywhere if we don't like them. And also, I've never seen an atmosphere in Washington, and I really think that the progressives and the Democrats have done a terrible job in not standing up to the current administration on a number of issues. And the farm bill was a great example, getting back to food. The giveaways and the failure of a number of, you know, people like Senator Harkin, for example, Senator Leahy, people who have been our friends in the past, who the give in to these Republicans for no reason I can possibly understand. You know, allowing, for instance, them to label irradiated food as pasteurized instead of irradiated. That was in the Farm Bill. Allowing for hundreds of millions of dollars to support biotechnology overseas. That was in there. Reducing protections for animals in almost every area. That got through. Backdoor deals by what is not a democracy anymore in Washington, D.C., but a corporate oligarchy that really needs to be fought on that basis, that we have stopped being a democratic country. You know, we have become a corporate oligarchy, a technological corporate oligarchy, and it is getting worse and worse in Washington, and to such an extent now that, except on a few issues, we don't even go to the Hill very much. We don't even lobby Congress very much. We tend to go to courts where at least you have a shot, you know, with a judge that might be favorable.
Oh, yeah, I was going to ask you about the courts, if there was any chance of of justice.
Well, we have some good judges, but again, remember the problem with an administration, you know, particularly if it were to go beyond one administration, is they then begin to appoint a lot of the judges that you're going to see at the various levels, all the way up through the Supreme Court. And so, again, it's very important to have progressive leaders in there who are appointing progressive judges who will support our causes. So, you know, it's again, it's all linked, unfortunately, in this. And then I think we need to go to the larger issue and begin to say, listen, we need to have a real democracy in this country. We need to have a democracy where we vote on whether we want genetically engineered foods. 90% of Americans don't. Do we want irradiated foods? 90% of Americans don't. Do we want to go to war with Iraq? Well, on our own. Most Americans say no. So despite all these things are happening. So we need to have a real democracy where we actually can vote on the things that affect our lives much more than voting for one bozo or another every 4 years. That's not democracy. That's a sham of democracy, as you so well know.
Right. And I hear that Washington, D.C. is pretty militarized. There are a lot of police around.
Well, the combination of the sniper that we're going through now and 9/11. But again, don't forget, these people take advantage of these crises to impose the kind of military state that they, you know, many, you know, people like Donald Rumsfeld, I always say he didn't get his second rabies shot. You know, you need both of them for it to work. These kind of people have this image in chain. They've had this image of a controlled country. You know, I call it a soft tyranny, a soft dictatorship for quite a while.
Yeah. And, well, it's not too soft for some people in prison.
It's getting harder and harder, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay, well, Andrew Kimbrell, thank you very much. And give your website one more time.
Yeah, Center for Food Safety, all one word, .org.
Center for Food Safety, all one word, .org. Well, thank you very much, and it's we're really fortunate to have people like you keeping your eye on things and fighting the good fight, and we need the movement to grow, as you said.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
My name's Sue Supriano. Thanks for listening.